Hi, and welcome to the Magazine Rec. I'm Chris. I'm Pete Anderson. Today I'll be reading from the July 8th, 2024 edition of the Hartford Business Journal. The first story we're looking at today is titled, Despite Mall Struggles, Broader Retail Real Estate Market Sees a Post-Pandemic Rebound. In-person retail is dead. That was a reframe shared by some experts during the pandemic, which led to a major uptick on online retail sales as people feared going to brick-and-mortar stores. Even before the pandemic, the rise of Amazon and other e-commerce giants raised questions about the future of in-person shopping. While it's true, some major U.S. retailers felt significant pain during the coming out of the pandemic, brand names like Sears, Bed Bath & Beyond, Lord & Taylor, and JCPenney filed for bankruptcy and shuttered stores in recent years. The retail real estate sector, not including mall properties, has stabilized and even experienced a comeback in certain areas, experts say, due to a rebounding demand for experimental or in-person consumerism. At the end of the first quarter of this year, the national shopping center vacancy rate was 5.4%, which was in line with the average over the prior four quarters and near the lowest level experienced in the last two decades, according to a recent report from real estate firm Cushman & Wakefield. Locally, retail property vacancy rates were even lower at 4.23% in the Hartford region, with almost 3.35 million square feet of vacant retail space, and 4.14% in Connecticut, or 9.42 million square feet of available space, according to real estate analytics CoStar. That data includes empty mall space. The retail market remains in a decidedly stronger place than prior to the pandemic, as consumers and retailers have shown a renewed appreciation for the in-person shopping experience, according to Cushman & Wakefield report. Dan Zelson is a principal at Westport-based Charter Realty and Zelco Properties and Development, which is managing the new 130,000-square-foot retail center within Cheshire's Stonebridge Crossing mixed-use development. Despite being more than a year away from debuting, Stonebridge Crossing retail space is already 80% leased, including by anchor tenant Whole Foods, which will occupy 40,000 square feet, Zelson said. Other tenants that have signed leases include Mercato Italian Kitchen and Bar, Marketplace Kitchen and Bar, Bird Code, Blender Bar, Chipotle, Saybrook Home Furnishings, TJ Maxx, Pet Supply, and Go Health Urgent Care. Zelson said he expects retail space within Stonebridge Crossing, which will also include apartments and townhouses, to be 100% occupied before any stores are open for business. Charter/Zelco manages more than 8 million square feet of retail space nationwide, and since the end of the pandemic, almost all of it, except mall space, has been absorbed, Zelson said. There's particularly low inventory of grocery store space, which has about a 2% vacancy rate nationwide, making that real estate among the most desirable, Zelson said. Contributing to the lack of inventory is a very few new builds coming online, he added. CoStar has tracked 13 retail centers that have been built in Connecticut since 2019, totaling 1.35 million square feet, and currently only three retail centers are under construction. Don Poland, Senior Vice President and Managing Director of Planning and Strategy at East Hartford-based real estate advocacy firm Gorman & York, said in-person retail centers are doing better compared with 3 or 4 years ago, but it's nuanced and variable. Segments of retail doing better, like food and beverage and national chains over locally owned, he added. Amazon-proof retail outlets include in-person grocery and clothing stores, salons, coffee shops, spas, dentists, recreation centers, bars, restaurants, and breweries, experts said. Households are increasingly shifting their consumption patterns to include more travel and consumer services, which benefits shopping centers that cater to those experiences, but pressures on traditional retailers that rely on discretionary retail spending, the Cushman & Wakefield report said. Through February, real estate sales declined in four of the past 5 months and were 1.6% lower than a year prior. Still, most of the retail sector remains healthy and in expansion mode, the report said. Nationally, the number of stores opening have outpaced closings for three consecutive quarters, the report added. Ben Starr, a partner in real estate services firm Atlantic Retail, said fitness centers and grocery stores are thriving. Retailers like Whole Foods, Wegmans, and Stu Leonard's are taking over vacant spaces throughout the state. Springfield-based Big Y recently debuted a new store in Brookfield and plans to open two additional Connecticut locations later this year in Middletown and Westport. In-person shopping has proved incredibly resilient, Starr said. The grocery sector is doing great, and it's indicative of what's going on outside the malls, which were overbuilt and now underperforming. Also, retailers pairing with other bargain stores like TJ Maxx locations will find strong demand and foot traffic. And many national retailers with their own branding are seeking new construction. Each retailer has its own product, their own building, so you're always going to see a new Starbucks, Chipotle, Whole Foods, Costco's. They want their own footprint, their own floor plan, Poland said. One challenge to new construction is the higher cost of materials and borrowing, Zelson said. New construction is really tough. Everything has to be perfect for those to occur, he said. If interest comes down and the prices level off, we may see more development. And new development is more often coming in the smaller sizes, industry experts agree, like custom-built shops for chain restaurants. There's much less appetite for new, large shopping centers. The rents don't justify new builds, especially larger-scale retail projects, Zelson said. The next story from the Hartford Business Journal is titled From Sea to Hotel. The story is subtitled Diversification Key to Clinton-Based Electric Grills, Cooktop Maker Kenyon International's Growth. Fire and boats don't mix, just ask Phil Williams, co-owner and president of Kenyon International, a Clinton-based manufacturer. My partners and I have an extensive background in the marine industry, and we have seen boats burn to the waterline because of people doing stupid things, he said. It's terrible to witness. While his privately held business has been based in Connecticut for more than 90 years, it has gone through several changes before ultimately becoming what it is today, a manufacturer of electric grills and ceramic glass cooktops for marine and other uses. Electric grills are much safer, Williams said. When we originally started designing our electric grill, it was specifically for the marine marketplace. We didn't want anything that was going to be dangerous to use on a boat, he continued. So everything that we put into designing our grill is going to make the easiest to use, easiest to clean, and the safest product. Kenyon didn't start as an electric grill maker. It was founded in 1931 by Theodore Ted Kenyon to make precision instruments for aviation and marine use. Kenyon's first patent, the company now has more than 70, was for a boat speedometer. He also had a background in aviation working for Grumman, which is now Northrop Grumman, as a pilot flying around the country to demonstrate its autopilot system. He later met and married Cecile Teddy Kenyon, who shared his love of flying. She won the National Sports Women's Flying Championship in 1933 and worked as a test pilot during World War II, according to the company's website. Together in 1953, the couple founded Kenyon Laboratories Incorporated in Lyme, where they designed and manufactured instruments and control equipment for aircraft and boats. Eventually, they also included creating cockpits and alcohol stoves for boats. By 1961, however, Kenyon Laboratories faced bankruptcy. It found a new lease on life, though, by selling gyro stabilizers under the new company name Chemlab Incorporated. By the 1980s, Chemlab had been acquired by a larger company, International Marine Industries, or IMI, which grew the cooktop business. It also acquired, in 1988, a St. Petersburg, Florida-based company called Crosby that had been launched by Williams, who had designed a new marine refrigerator system. 8 years later, Williams and some friends bought Kenyon from IMI and relocated it to Clinton. At the time, the company had about 20 employees and produced items solely for the marine industry. When we bought the company in 96, we started looking at what our strengths and our weaknesses were, Williams said. We were determined to be able to take the organization that we had and actually grow this in a meaningful way. That meant looking into other markets, which led Kenyon to developing products for extended stay hotels, which started developing our cooktops so that they would fit into a small kitchenette, whether it be for retiring baby boomers or if any other applications, William said. Now we are the leading supplier to the hotel industry for their extended stay flags, Marriott, Hilton, IHG, which is Intercontinental Hotel Group. Any hotel that has properties which they put kitchenettes in, we are a supplier to them. In fact, he said, that is now the biggest segment of Kenyon's business. It's not, however, the only way Kenyon diversified. It also supplies cooktops for housing and to all branches of the U.S. military, as well as for academic housing, assisted living facilities, and RVs. It also works with home builders, providing both cooktops and electric grills. The diversification was important to the company's survival, Williams said. We needed to have three legs to this stool so that we wouldn't fall over. The electric grill business for maritime use started in earnest in 2005 when Kenyon designed and manufactured a grill specifically for the marine marketplace. The company produces electric grills in a variety of designs and sizes, ranging from the portable to the built-in. Last month, it introduced the signature grill, which Williams lauded for its design. I've seen a lot of really nice grills, but this one, in all the features that it includes, far surpasses anything that I've ever seen produced by any company anywhere, he said. The signature grill is powered by two independent 1,500-watt elements operated at 240 volts with 13 amps. It features a lid with three layers of stainless steel that includes vents in the middle layer to allow air to move through, keeping most of the heat from reaching the outer layer. While the lid does get warm, it doesn't get hot enough to burn like a gas or charcoal grill would burn, Williams said. The lid also is removable and dishwasher safe. Other features include an optional patented rotating handle that has a built-in high-intensity LED light that illuminates the entire grill surface and a digital temperature control system that can actually dial the temperature you want the grilling surface to be, he said. The temperature also can be locked so children can't change it, he added. For all of its grills and cooktops, Kenyon uses U.S.-produced materials whenever possible, including all of the metal. Some of the parts are brought in from overseas only because nobody in the United States is making it, Williams said. Since Kenyon mostly sells its products directly to manufacturers, the military, hotels, or builders, that did not allow it to develop a strong network of brick-and-mortar retailers, Williams said, while adding that it has now become a focus to help the company grow. Kenyon recently developed a relationship with West Marine, a Fort Lauderdale, Florida-based chain of boating supply and fishing retail stores, he said. West Marine has placed Kenyon grills in 13 of its stores, including one in Old Saybrook. Overall, Kenyon products are sold in about 30 locations, including 9 in New York, 2 in New Jersey, and 1 each in California, Louisiana, Maryland, North Carolina, and Texas. While our network is currently small, there's a lot of room for growth in that area, which we intend to pursue heavily over the next few years and beyond, Williams said. Like most manufacturers, the pandemic presented challenges for Kenyon. When Connecticut started shutting down most businesses, Kenyon was able to remain open because it manufactured cooktops for the military, making it a government supplier. The pandemic was really scary as a business owner, Williams said. Our cooktop business declined during the pandemic because so many of our accounts around the country had to stop the construction on their facilities. But the grill business went through the roof. People wanted to update their outdoor kitchens or build an outdoor kitchen. The marine industry also experienced growth in boat sales, which boosted Kenyon's business. The company now employs 53 people, and Williams, who declined to disclose annual revenue figures, said Kenyon added more salespeople earlier this year. "We've got a very good crew," he said. "A lot of them have been with us for many, many years." He added that Kenyon provides benefits that match those provided by submarine maker Electric Boat and Groton. "We have to, because we're competing against them for engineers and for workers," Williams said. "We do well making sure our employees are taken care of." Turning now to our next story from the Hartford Business Journal. This is titled Evolving Landscape. This story is subtitled, "With Revenue Sharing and Direct Payments to Athletes Looming, College Sports Won't Be the Same." College athletes have been allowed to benefit financially from their names, images, and likeness only since July 2021. Yet, the 3 years since the National Collegiate Athletic Association, or NCAA, approved its initial NIL policy, it has grown into an industry valued at an estimated $1 billion annually. A change on the horizon, though, is expected to significantly alter the landscape for both NIL and college athletes. The shift is likely to be a direct result of a $2.8 billion settlement agreement the NCAA reached in May with former college athletes who had filed an antitrust class action lawsuit demanding compensation that had been denied to them. A condition of that agreement, which still must be approved by the judge, would allow school athletic departments to directly share with athletes the revenue from ticket sales and TV contracts. It sets the amount to be shared at 22% of that revenue to start, or roughly more than $20 million per school per year. While NIL allows businesses and organizations to pay athletes for promotional purposes and for athletes to sell branded and autographed merchandise, the settlement agreed, if approved, would set the stage for colleges and universities to directly pay what amounts to a salary to their athletes. If that happens, experts say, it would be a major shift resulting in collegiate sports looking nothing like what exists now. And that could have major ramifications for UConn, which has Connecticut's most high-profile college athletic programs, as well as small universities in the state. Jared Guy Thomas is executive director of Bleeding Blue for Good, the nonprofit NIL collective that raises money for UConn athletes. Thomas, a former Army officer and lawyer, helped create and then ran the NIL collective at Purdue University for 14 months. He was then hired by UConn to run the NIL collective shortly after the men's basketball team won the 2023 national title. "When the national champs call, you answer and you come running," Thomas said. Utilizing his legal and college athletic background, Thomas produces his own predictive analysis of the likely outcome for collegiate athletics and NIL, and he sees one certainty. "I believe very firmly that the one component of this NIL that will never go back into the box completely is the idea of corporate endorsement deals," he said. When the U.S. Supreme Court in June of 2021 unanimously ruled against the NCAA in its lawsuit versus former West Virginia football player Sean Anston over education-related benefits, the decision that opened the door for NIL, the justices identified a fundamental right for college athletes, Thomas said. "In law school, we called it the right of publicity, the right for a player to profit off their own face," he said. "If Gatorade comes to a player at UConn and offers them an endorsement deal, the Supreme Court essentially said it's their right to take that deal." Which makes sense, he added, in an era when so many college students are social media influencers with millions of followers. regardless of where this settlement goes, regardless of any new NCAA guidelines, regardless of any federal legislation, the Supreme Court was adamant that the endorsement deals are going to exist, Thomas said. As permanent as the endorsement side of the NIL may be, the future role of collectives like Bleeding Blue for Good is far less clear. Dan Murphy, a staff writer for the Bristol-based sports giant ESPN, who covers NIL for the network, says the old booster clubs, groups of alums and business people who donated cash to support college athletic teams, have been replaced by collectives. It used to be that booster clubs would pass the hat around so you could stick the whole bag full of cash in a player's locker, Murphy said. That sort of operation is now run by people with tons of experience in fundraising and the sports industry, and in a much more formal and organized way. In the NIL era, he said, upwards of 80% of the dollars that go to athletes come from these collectives as opposed to more traditional endorsement deals. Within the first few months of NIL, Murphy said, boosters figured out a way that they could use collectives in a way to pay athletes so they could recruit the best talent and retain the best talent for their schools. Now, though, many schools are concerned that they have lost control over which players were showing up at their schools, he said. The collective was the one who had the money and was paying the payroll. In fact, NCAA rules initially prohibited schools from interacting with collectives, which didn't make sense, Murphy said, so that's changing. He agrees that NIL endorsement deals are here to stay, but says the collective stuff is a little bit more in doubt because of the pending settlement agreement. Anyone who tells you they know the answer to this is lying to you, he said, of the question about what the future holds for NIL. The schools, the athletic directors themselves, they don't know exactly what will happen to NIL. Of course, that doesn't mean there are no educated guesses. Murphy said the settlement agreement is aimed at reining in NIL collectives and bringing that more in-house by letting schools pay the athletes directly for their NIL rights. While the agreement caps those direct payments at about $20 million a year, some schools have a budget big enough to pay more than that for athletes, he said. When there's an opportunity to pay $1 more to get the better recruit, somebody in college sports is going to find a way to do that to gain a competitive edge. UConn Athletic Director David Benedict views that issue another way. He expects the NCAA to move toward a revenue-sharing model, which he said would create somewhat of a level playing field, but he does not believe it will be required of every school. There will be some campuses that don't have any money to share, he said. So from that standpoint, the enterprise is going to evolve because that's new. The NCAA may say this is the money that you can share, and you get to decide how and who you share it with, Benedict said, but collectives raising money from donors and then providing that to the student athletes is probably going to die down or be eliminated once you get to a place that there's revenue sharing. Once the NCAA adopts the revenue sharing model, it raises other issues, including that athletes may try to unionize. Eric Brown, a labor and employment attorney in Watertown who counsels college athletes, said he believes that's inevitable. I think it's ultimately going to happen because it always happens when there's big money around, he said. The ability of student athletes to unionize depends on whether they can be considered employees since they would now be paid. If they are, Brown said, there are many issues to negotiate, including whether athletes are paid for their performance or just for participating. Can a scholarship be considered a form of payment, he added. And if it is, it's going to be taxable as income. What kind of benefits are going to be available? And can you cut players if they're not performing? Murphy said another issue concerns the 22% rate for revenue sharing. The question is, are athletes going to be happy with that rate forever, he said. Still, organizing college athletes won't be easy, Murphy said, because they are a very transient population who have a lot of other stuff going on and are only 18 to 22 years old for the most part. Can they organize themselves and create the kind of union that would have enough resolve to have some negotiating power? The athletes also face another huge hurdle. The NCAA and its members are very much against student-athletes being considered employees, Murphy said, because it raises issues such as eligibility for workers' compensation and complicates the coach-slash-athlete relationship. The NCAA is already lobbying Congress to pass a law to prevent it, he added. Brown said there are other issues related to the settlement agreement that must be ironed out, including how the shared revenue will be distributed. Are all the sports going to be treated equally, or are there going to be prorated payments based on a revenue projection basis, he added. That's an especially acute question when Title IX is considered. The federal law requires male and female student athletes to be treated equally. Will that apply to revenue sharing? Brown asked, since we certainly know the revenue from women's-based sports is lower than revenue from men-based sports. For Murphy, the ESPN writer, the biggest unknown is whether revenue sharing will ultimately cause most successful and profitable schools, particularly in football, to split off from the NCAA. I don't think that's a foregone conclusion, he said, but I do think it increases the likelihood that the biggest schools eventually will decide that they need to form their own league. Of course, college athletics has gone through many changes over the decades, and schools have adjusted, Murphy says. There will come a time soon when schools have to decide what their alums and fans will support. Do you want to be a school that is in what might be a full-blown future entertainment industry-level professional sports league, he asked? Or is it important to you to feel more like an Ivy League, the way that's more what you might have thought of college sports in the past? I think schools have been able to straddle those two worlds for the last quarter century, he said, and I think the time is coming to an end. You're going to have to pick a lane and stick with it. This story has a sidebar with it. It's titled Big Deal for the Big East. As UConn continues to navigate the NIL era, its conference recently signed a deal to bring in more money. On June 27th, the 11-school Big East Conference announced a new media rights agreement that is estimated to nearly double its annual rights payments. Financial terms were not disclosed, but the sports business website Sportico said the conference's existing 12-year deal, which ends after the 2024-2025 season, was worth $41.7 million a year. The new six-year agreement, which begins with the 2025-26 season, is estimated to be nearly double that, with annual rights payments in the range of $75 million to $80 million per year. While the current contract places games with Fox and CBS, the new contract coverage on Fox Sports, that's Fox, FS1, and FS2, as well as on NBC Sports, which includes NBC and Peacock, and TNT Sports, which includes TNT, TBS, True TV, and Max. The agreement provides for major national broadcast, cable, and direct consumer streaming coverage of Big East men's and women's basketball games and Olympic sport championship contests. Well, that's it for this installment of the Magazine Rack. I've been reading from the July 8th, 2024 edition of the Hartford Business Journal. I'm Pete Anderson. So long until next time.